Well, the Red Sox have played their last game in good old Fenway Park. They're going to tear down the old Green Goblin.
Monster.
Really? Where? Greg, run for your life!
No, I mean it's called the Green Monster. And anyway...
Okay, maybe I don't know that much about baseball, but I know how the mind of the collector works. Once the wrecking ball hits this old heap, the eBay market for pieces is going to be super crazy. That's why I'm here ahead of the crowds with my crowbar.
There's no wrecking ball.
Oh, they're going to go for implosion instead? That's probably the right move. I mean, push the button and drop that sucker with one big bang. Anyway, I'm going to take out a couple of these urinals to sell to collectors. Just think of all the beer that went through one of those things. It's probably, if I'm guessing here, the equivalent of Lake Placid, probably.
But you...
Hold that thought, Greg. That was easier than I thought it would be. Now you put on the hazmat suit and drag this thing to the pickup.
You're misinformed.
No, Greg, I was miscongeniality. But what does my finish at the Shad Derby Queen pageant have to do with this?
There's no demolition of Fenway. It's an active ballpark. People will be coming back here in a few days to watch playoff games.
Seriously?
Yes.
Okay, I gotta improvise here. Hey, set this pile of Cracker Jacks on fire, and we'll use the diversion to make our escape.
Yeah, no. They started making Cracker Jack flame retardant in 1983.
You know what you are? You're the party of no. I'm getting a little sick of that. What did you do, read some kind of book about baseball objects? By the way, that's the topic of our show today. Now, you know what? It's not like we can put the urinal back. Help me drag it to the truck. And now, his favorite ice cream flavor is Salt of La Macchia's Nut Cup, Colin McEnroe.
It sounds good anyway, but then you think about it some more and maybe not so much. Yeah, we are actually out reading a book and talking to an author about the material world of baseball. And baseball has a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff in a lot of sports, but baseball, I think, is encrusted with stuff. And that's the way Steve Rushen went at it. He has written for Sports Illustrated for the past 25 years and was the 2006 National Sports Writer of the Year. He is the author most recently of the book I hold in my hand here, The 34-Ton Bat, The Story of Baseball, as told through bobbleheads, Cracker Jacks, Jock Straps, and Eye Black. Those are not the names of players, by the way. And 375 other strange and unforgettable objects. It's a very long title, but it's a delightful book. We have been having a lot of fun with it. And Steve, it's great to have you back in the studio.
Thanks for having me, Colin.
I don't know where you want to start. And we should just say as we go along here, Steve has devoted quite a bit of research to not only to the sort of material facts of, but the personal stories behind the balls, the bats, yes, the eye black and the jock straps and the cups that go inside the jock straps and the food that's served at the games and you name it. He's looked into it. If you have a question or a comment, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. I'm trying to decide whether we should start with something really intrinsic to the game, like a ball, or something that's a little bit more tangential to the game, like food or the pipe organs. Maybe we should start with the ball. Because the ball in baseball is, as you say, a very complicated thing. It's at certain times, anyway, the materials have come from, what, five different continents?
Yeah, from the phrase whipping the ball around the horn. That phrase around the horn comes from sailors rounding Cape Horn at the southernmost tip of South America. And that ball comes from these constituent parts around the world, cork from Asia and yarn from another place, the whitened Holstein cowhides from the United States. And the constituent parts at various times have come from five different continents, and they all sort of come together in this baseball. And the thing that I really intrigued me about this as a book subject, though, were a lot of the things that you mentioned, the kind of esoteric objects that I fell in love with. When I was 13 years old, I got a job at Met Stadium where the Twins played, and it was like this Wonka factory of baseball objects. There were the balls in their pristine condition, and new in their cases, but there were also frosty malts and snow cones and broken bats and beer bottles stacked on pallets and Cracker Jack and hot dogs. And I actually was a dog stabber at the games. I would stab the hot dogs that the vendors would take around and stab them, put them in their buns. And all of those things, you know, not just the baseball and the bats and the caps and the uniforms, which I loved, but all the other ephemeral stuff. And I was at the Red Sox game with my daughter this summer, and she had one of those sundaes in a batting helmet in a Red Sox batting helmet, not game worn, unfortunately, but I'm sure that's coming.
Or fortunately.
Yeah, yeah. And when she got to the bottom of it, you know, of this Red Sox batting helmet, inside it says Made in China at the bottom. I just love this. You know, it was kind of a beautiful America in a nutshell here. And I look at this as baseball, you know, in a peanut shell, kind of this history of the game.
Yeah, actually, there's quite a bit in the book about peanuts and not only the relationship of peanuts to the fans, but the players, too. Clearly one player who would go in after, I guess, a successful pitching outing and demand peanuts from the ownership. This was back in the days when the players were playing for peanuts.
Right. He'd take his one of the Brooklyn Dodgers would go into the GM's office afterwards where they would keep these peanuts stacked by the sackful and demand his compensation and peanuts. And there are a lot of characters like this in the book. Harry Stevens, who was the famous concessionaire who emigrated from the UK to Ohio in the 1800s, it was said of him that he was the only guy who would keep the money out on the table and the liquor locked up in the safe. So there's a lot of affection for food and drink in this book among players and fans alike.
Yeah, I want to come back to Harry Stevens because he is the guy. I mean, there really is sort of a guy for a lot of these stories. Sometimes it's a responsibility and credit that can be spread among a bunch of different actors in a drama, but he really is the hot dog guy. He's the baseball hot dog guy. I mean, you know, more than any other human being. Let's come back to him. I want to stay with balls for just a second. Bunch of interesting things in this chapter. And by the way, one of the nice things about this book, Steve Rushen's book, The 34-Ton Bat, is, I mean, there are some really funny, colorful stories. There are also some very wrenching stories and some very kind of close-to-the-bone dramatic stories about this. And in just a second, we'll talk about the significance of baseballs and their relationship to grenades in both World War I and World War II. But I just want to pause over the sort of role of the ball and the fans. You know, the fans now come to games and they've got gloves and everything and they're like really ready to catch a ball. Although invariably, if you're watching any baseball game, there's always some ball that ricochets off a rail and smacks somebody in the face. But for a long time, this notion that you get to keep the ball was not an understood thing, not the default setting of baseball. There was even some little kid who was he jailed for?
There was an 11-year-old kid who was jailed overnight by the Philadelphia Phillies, and that more than anything, I think, brought an end to. Originally, if you caught a foul ball and you didn't return it to the field, cops or security in the stands would come and take it away from you, and if you refused to give it up, they'd eject you from the game. And one guy actually sued the New York Giants for ejecting him from a game for keeping the ball. The one exception was if a serviceman caught a ball, they generally let him keep it. And oftentimes a kid would catch a ball and hand it to the serviceman until the security went away, and then he might give it back to the kid. But balls cost money, and owners were cheap and still are. And the tradition of letting fans keep balls didn't really take hold among all teams until the 30s, and even in the 40s, they had a drive to return foul balls to send overseas to so servicemen could play with them in World War II.
You know, and even sort of watching that unfold over the time of our lives as baseball fans, it happens to be today my birthday. I think I'm like 100, but I'm not 100% sure. But, you know, when I was a kid, yeah, if something went into the stands, you could keep it. But that was really the only circumstance. Now it's any ball that any player kind of comes up with and doesn't have to throw right back in somewhere. They mostly just sort of toss them up there now.
Yeah, and the ball girls toss them up there. You know, the players coming into the dugout from the field toss them up there. You know, there are still owners who don't like it. And I did a story on designated hitters this summer for Sports Illustrated. And Gaylord Perry, even after the DH rule was passed, loved to take batting practice with the Seattle Mariners, even though he would never get into a game. And he would just rip balls into the stands. He was a great batting practice hitter. And the Mariners owner, George Argyros, finally told the BP pitcher to stop throwing batting practice to Perry because he was hitting, you know, a dozen balls into the stands, empty stands at the Kingdom every day. So it hasn't quite ended, but balls and you see somebody kicks a football into the stands at an NFL game, people think that they ought to be able to keep it, that it's their birthright to keep whatever goes into the stands at a game.
You know, in the chapter about balls, and by the way, if you have questions, comments, not about just about balls, bats, the food at baseball parks, the flannel uniforms, the flip shades, the eye black, whatever it is, 860-275-7266. Steve Rushen is prepared at least to entertain any question you have about the material world of baseball, not necessarily to answer it, but to entertain it and to be entertained by it. 860-275-7266. We'll also tell you in just a second about the role that really, really stinky, horrible, inadequate toilets played in in one team's decision to relocate. Whenever I think of toilets in baseball, I think of Marv Thornberry. But anyway, our number 860-275-7266. We're live here in the afternoon. We'd like to get you involved. I should say, in a little while, we are going to take a short break for a pledge drive. And we're talking about merch today, in, as they say, with Steve Rushen's book and bobblehead dolls and things like that. We actually today are introducing the first ever Colin McEnroe Show merch. There's a Colin McEnroe Show mug, which we encourage you to hear about during the pledge drive and then to order. It's going to be for a pledge of $60 or more. And it's a very nice and very flattering, more flattering than I deserve, illustration of me by Constanza Segovia, a great little kind of rendering of the Colin McEnroe Show name. A warning, it says caution, hot beverages may be hot, stuff like that. You're going to love this mug, and it's a great thing. So buy our merch today and also get Steve Rushen's merch, which is his book, The 34-Ton Bat, which has a very long subtitle. It is about merch, not just merch, but all the kind of material things that go with baseball. The chapter about balls, just to sort of wrap this up, this is a lengthy and a topic worthy of consideration. Obviously, as baseball caught on as a new sport in the late 19th century, early 20th century, American arms got really a lot better. You had a lot of people just playing a game that involved throwing a ball. Then you had a succession of world wars in which people could conceivably be asked to throw grenades. But as one of the things you point out is grenades, for the most part, were not shaped like balls.
No, grenades were shaped like pineapples, and American kids didn't know how to throw pineapples particularly well, but they knew how to throw baseballs. So from beginning, before World War I, there was an effort by the U.S. military to develop a baseball-shaped grenade, and that continued throughout the 20th century. Eventually, by mid-Vietnam War, the M67 grenade was round, no longer pineapple-shaped, but weighed about four times the amount of a regulation baseball. But in World War II, they developed a tear gas baseball grenade, and Dave Ferris, the Red Sox pitcher, was pictured in full uniform in Popular Mechanics, you know, winding up and preparing to throw this tear gas grenade. And, you know, and it makes sense when you think about it because kids, baseball was the most popular sport, and they wanted to develop a grenade that weighed 5 1/4 ounces like a baseball and had the same size and weight and hand feel as a baseball.
Yeah, in one of the conflagrations, I forget whether it was one or two, there was a description of American soldiers coming over to assist the French. The French, of course, play a game called boule or pétanque, which involves pretty much gently, underhandedly tossing heavy balls towards one another on a lawn. Not good preparation for throwing a grenade. So it was the case immediately, right, that the Americans could outthrow the French.
Right, but they were seen as the great grenadiers, the French word, and that was their expertise. But and there was also a competition between Americans and Brits over the best throwing motion, whether it was a cricket pitching motion or a baseball throwing motion.
We're talking to Steve Rushen. We're talking about all the material things of baseball. We're going to have to take a break in just a second. But as long as we're talking about balls, let's talk about cups. You do tell the story of this one guy who he actually invented the cup not as a result of – and the cup would be the hard groin-protecting thing that can be placed inside a jock strap in order to protect your valuables. And it wasn't a baseball accident. It wasn't a boxing accident. It was an opera accident, right?
It was a terrible opera accident. The American debut of Turandot at the Metropolitan Opera, this guy Foulproof Taylor was in the chorus at the Metropolitan Opera, and he was speared coming off.
He wasn't
off,
known as Foulproof Taylor at
not,
the time.
Not yet.
He wasn't.
No, he was not yet foulproof, but he was walking off stage at the end of Act One, and he was accidentally speared in the groin by another member of the chorus carrying a spear. And after the show that night, he went down to the Bowery, and he bought some aluminum and some rubber novelty cigars that he fashioned around this aluminum and made a cup. And the next night he came and asked the spear carrier to spear me here. And the spear carrier happily obliged, and he was fine. And so he started taking that around the New York boxing gyms, eventually to baseball clubhouses, and as his foul-proof cup. That in its own way did really revolutionize boxing, because in the 1920s, if there was a low blow below the belt in a fight, the fight was canceled and all bets were called off. And so a mobster who had a fighter losing in the ring could just tell him to throw a low blow and the bets would be off. And so they needed to develop some kind of a cup so that heavyweight fights could be played out to their end.
We're going to have to take a break here in just a second, just to kind of conclude this, though. I mean, once again, this turns into a series of, as you might expect, colorful stories. First of all, Fileproof Taylor continues to demonstrate his product in the same way by inviting people to strike him or kick him in this particular area. But not everybody, even though this affords a tremendous amount of protection from something that happens only once in a rare while, but all the same, you are in a situation where a missile can be rocketing towards you and can just as easily hit you there as anywhere else. And certainly for catchers and umps, there's a huge hazard. But you talk about one baseball player, Pepper Martin, who played, as we call it, the hot corner.
Yeah.
Where, in fact, the ball can get to you pretty fast and hit you there. And he simply chose not to do this.
And he dodged bullets throughout his long career. And he's the guy that Leo Durocher said, God watches over drunks and third basemen.
And then the last part of the story, it almost seems like it has to be apocryphal, but maybe it's not, is that later on as a manager, he discovered that one of his players, Red Shandings, was not wearing a cup. And he, Pepper Martin, the person who had eschewed the cup, insisted that Red Shandings put one on. And that very game, apparently, you can pick up the story.
He took a line drive there. It was the cup was shattered, but Red was not.
Yeah.
And very few people have dared to not wear one since.
Right. Cracked in half like a walnut shell, we're told. All right. We got to take a break here. We're visiting with Steve Rushen. We'll take that break. Then we'll come back. I hit 363 with home runs, RBIs, and a winning ideology. All right, we're talking to Steve Rushen. Actually, we were talking off the air about baseball announcers. That could be a whole other book because the things that baseball announcers say and the topics that they undertake are fascinating. We were just talking about Dennis Eckersley. Another thing that Dennis Eckersley talked about, philosophized about recently that I loved is how fast you walk off the mound. He said, you know, if you walk slowly off the mound after you've just, you know, struck out the side or something like that, you have to do the same thing when they come out and take the ball away from you. you can't go, look at me when you've done something well, and then go scurrying to the dugout when you've had a bad
The great
inning.
Thing about that is Sean McDonough told me, another baseball announcer, that the ball is in play for 15 minutes of an actual baseball game. That's when you're describing action. The other 2 hours, 45 minutes, or in the case of the Red Sox, the other 3 hours and 45 minutes, you have time to talk, and that's what's great about it.
Well, we talked about balls. We've got to talk about bats. This is all in connection with Steve Rushen's new book, The 34-Ton Bat. The story of baseball is told through bobbleheads, cracker jacks, jock straps, eye black, and 375 other strange and unforgettable objects. A bat was sort of anything you could swing, right? I mean, it wasn't a tapered piece of ash, or it was kind of could be just about anything.
It could be a table leg. It could be a wagon tongue. It could be a bedpost. And in fact, Johann Hilleric, who emigrated from Germany and created Hilleric and Bradsby and the Louisville Slugger, initially his wood turning business was making balustrades and bedposts and railings and things like that. And he had no interest in making the bats that his son Bud wanted him to make, because Bud, like an American kid, got to love baseball. And
a bat could be, I mean, you know, we've been through a huge controversy in our lifetimes about like how far the pine tar can be on George Brett's bat and stuff like that. But back in those days, you could walk up there with almost anything. One guy had a bat with kind of two knobs down at the end,
yeah,
right? One for each hand.
Yeah, used two knobs. You know, there were banana-shaped bats, the banana bat that could kind of put a high-lie curve on the ball. And it was an arms race for a while. I write in the section about baseballs about this Princeton professor, Charles Hinton, who developed a gun that the pitcher could use to save his arm to fire baseballs at the batter. And he thought that was going to revolutionize the game. The pitcher would just have to field his position. So you could have a guy up there with a banana-shaped bat facing a pitcher with a baseball bazooka. It would be kind of fun to see that played out today.
Charles Hinton married to one of the Boole girls from Boolean Logic, but apparently did not improve his logic about how baseball was going to work. So the Hilleric story is really interesting, too, because Dad doesn't see the point of this. You know, he's in more of the kind of bespoke, you know, wood thing, you know, for beds and you know, rails of stairways and stuff like that. Balustrades, I guess that's what those are called. And meanwhile, his son is kind of a baseball fan, and his son hooks up with this especially colorful player. I think this is Browning, is his
Pete
name?
Pete Browning.
Yeah. Who is, well, you should say a little something about Pete
Browning.
Well,
he was nuts. There's really no other way to put it. he liked to drink. He was frequently described as drunk during games and newspaper accounts of the day. He was once literally caught napping off second base, picked off while dozing, standing up. And he, like a lot of great hitters, and he was a great hitter of his day, he sort of fetishized his eyes and his eyesight, and he liked to bathe his – he called his eyes his lamps. He liked to bathe them in buttermilk and
– and stare at the sun with them.
And stare at the sun with them, yeah, to improve his eyesight. But he also, like so many players from Ted Williams before and after, he took great care of his bats, and he named some of them and kept them in wonderful condition. And he was the first guy that Bud Hillerich started making custom bats for.
By the way, the other person who believed that staring at the sun was good for your eyes was Timothy Dwight, the great New Haven divine and president of Yale. And he had really bad eyes, and he would stare at the sun with them to make them better. So, but, you know, and so this guy, he gets a whole bunch of – he has, like, a great game the first time somebody gives him a – Bud Hillerich gives him that bat.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And Bud recognized that if this guy had a great game, and he gets the word out that this guy's using his bats, and every team that then comes through Louisville can stop by their shop and get a bat, it becomes very popular, and much more so than the bedposts and stair railings ever would be. And that finally persuades his dad that, you know, this is a big, smart business. And he eventually secures the endorsements of the best players in the game. And, you know, and the rest is history.
You know, there's sort of these iconic notions of baseball, images of baseball. And so there's, you know, the idea that the first sounds of spring is the satisfying thwap of ash against horsehide, except that it's not ash anymore, right? I mean, thanks to the emerald ash borer.
Yeah, the emerald ash borer, like chestnut blight and Dutch elm disease, the ash tree has been blighted as well. And, you know, maple bats, hybrid bats. Biggest of all, of course, aluminum bats in around 1970 that completely changed the way everybody but Major League Baseball players, professional baseball players, play the game. So, yeah, a bat is just about anything now, but the romance of it still is that wooden bat that Johan Hillerich turned, you know, when he was turning bedposts. And I tell the story in the book. Just before he passed away, Catfish Hunter, the great Yankees and A's pitcher, I visited him down in North Carolina, and he actually had a balustrade made out of the Louisville Sluggers of various Hall of Fame players that he had faced in his career. And that's where he kept all his memorabilia, up in this loft that the stairway led to. And here now, 130 years later, or whatever it was, Johan Hillerich had in fact made a balustrade in a beautiful home out of the Louisville Sluggers that his son had converted the business to.
We're talking to Steve Rushen. We're going to take a break in just about 3 minutes to do a little bit of fundraising. We do hope you'll think about getting the Colin McEnroe Show mug. It's its first day, really, and we're very excited about it. But before we go there, I mean, the other part of – well, just back to the bats for a second, because there are doomsayers or something, aluminum sayers in your book who basically say, look, once the aluminum bat's here, you know, that's it. It's all over. I don't see how they can ever be used at the major league level, because they would really be incredibly dangerous.
There would be no Pepper Martins with aluminum bats in play. They would be very dangerous, and you'd have to increase the dimensions of the parks, you know, twice as what they are now. So there can't be. There have to be. Even at the college level, they've had to put sort of governors on these bats, because they really are deadly weapons. They've been deadly weapons in other contexts, of course, wooden bats, and the stories in the book about, you know, Al Capone and that scene from where he's beating three informants with the baseball bat. Other sources say it was something called an Indian club. But, you know, the bat has been this menacing thing as well as this great symbol, you know, and there's plenty of pictures in the book of players kissing their bats for the AP photographer. There was a custom for 30 years in baseball where, you know, kiss the bat, Bobby Thompson, that you've just hit the shot heard around the world with, and some would comply happily and others would look angry. But
between kissing the bat and then putting the eye black on, and actually you resolve in your book or appear to resolve in your book a whole question that many of us had, whether eye black actually does anything.
I would like to take credit for that. It was the Yale researchers actually who did a study whether or not it was just a placebo effect or if it really worked. And it seems to be that it does have some slight positive effect. The actual eye black, paraffin and grease and all that, the decals that people put on now that have Bible John 3:16 or their area code on it seem to be less effective than the actual stuff.
Recently I've seen catchers who will put neon nail polish. Have you seen this now?
Sure,
the catchers who put the neon nail polish on their nails so that when they're flashing the signs, particularly at some of the more myopic pitchers, can actually see the configuration of their fingers. So I'm thinking, you know, eye black, kissing the bat. Now you got the neon nail polish on. I mean, it's getting pretty birdcage here.
Some of these guys, I think, just like to wear it. They're getting
more and more tranny all the time. There'll be some reason next why they have to wear brassieres or something. All right, so we're talking to Steve Rushen. The book is The 34-Ton Bat. We haven't covered urinals. We haven't covered pipe organs, which ideally are not connected to one another. We haven't covered food. I'm fascinated by the food. So when we come back, we'll try to figure out what a white Pope is, something that somebody used to consume at baseball games, along with boxes of chocolate on hot summer days, and why they don't serve grilled tripe anymore. We'll also tell you a little bit of a story about why one team moved, at least partly, because their bathrooms were so stinky and horrible.
Might see a triple play, a shutout game, and inside the park home run. No matter what happens, if we win or lose, we're gonna persevere. And if we don't make the World Series now, there's always next year. Oh, baseball.
Buy me some peanuts and crack. I'm really struggling with this lyric. Buy me some peanuts and crack. Tucker, what else do they sell at baseball games besides peanuts and crack? Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our interns, Garrett Connolly and Albert Gordon. Voiceover help in the intro by Greg Hill. The part of Bill Curry was played by Minnie Minoso. On tomorrow's show, our salute to the Scottish play. And now, back to Colin.
Minnie Minoso, by the way, I believe holds the record for the most decades in which he made professional plate appearances. It was like 6 or 7 different
decades.
That's
right. Yeah. That's right.
In which he somehow, sometimes with rather obscure, independent professional teams.
I hope a pipe organist played Minnie the Moocher one of his walk-ups.
Steve Rushen, author of The 34-Ton Bat, we have to talk about pipe organists. This is, unfortunately, a dying, if not completely dead, tradition. But baseball stadiums typically had these organists there. Some of them were, like John Kiley of the Boston Red Sox, veterans of the silent film industry that had accompanied movies. And some of them were really, really inventive in terms of the things that they chose to play.
Yeah, we think of this as going back to the beginning of time, but Phil Wrigley with the Chicago Cubs had the first organist in 1941. It wasn't until then, and that was to play classical music. But the next year, the Brooklyn Dodgers got a Hammond organ, and they installed this woman, Gladys Gooding, behind it, and she was great at kind of sonic puns and insults to opposing players. She's the one who played Three Blind Mice and outraged the umpires, And Warren Spahn, she would look up, okay, Warren Spahn, he's pitching today, it's his birthday today. Warren Spahn threw 15 2/3 innings against the Dodgers at Ebbets Field on his birthday, lost 2-1, and he was walking off the mound. She finally played Happy Birthday to You. So she knew how to use the organ as a weapon, really.
Yeah, there's some great examples of this. I was telling Mr. Dankowski before we went on the air, my favorite organist that I knew anything about is Nancy Faust, Chicago, right?
She, right.
Yeah. And she would do the same thing, these kind of walk-up songs. And they were, for the most part, kind of affectionately done as opposed to an attempt to rattle some player. But my favorite invention of hers was when the player Dave Concepcion would come up, she would play I Get Ideas, which I think is sort of a genius connection. And so immediately Mr. Dankowski told me that the Pittsburgh organist, Vince Lachide, I think was his name, towards the end of Johnny Bench's Hall of Fame career with the Cincinnati Reds, when he would come to the plate, Lachide would play Catch a Falling Star, and that Johnny Bench confronted him about it, you know, in the hallways afterwards.
But how great is that? Johnny Bench recognized what he was playing, and you know, that's what we've lost. Nancy Faust, the White Sox would also play Olivia Newton-John's Physical, you know, Let's Get Physical, for Omar Vizquel. So that takes a little bit of figuring out.
It's
as
a homonym.
Well. Exactly.
All right.
And an homage.
And an homage, indeed. All right. We'd love to hear from you at 860-275-7266. Here's Brett from Newington. Hi, Brett.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine.
You were alluding to before baseball being somewhat a feminist sport, you didn't use those words, but I mean, just because they're wearing bobby socks or stockings or knickers or trousers with no pockets and matching blouses with no collars or pockets and nice embroidery and patterns and cute little hats and custom fit gloves in no way makes it an effeminate sport.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, the story of these, the stockings and the socks and stuff, first of all, I want to thank you, Steve Rushton, for this, too, because I grew up with a mother who, whenever I, as a child, did something that where I would get a cut or something and I wasn't treating it or something like that, would tell me the story of Calvin Coolidge's son and then would say he was the most powerful man in the world and he could do nothing to save his son. His son died anyway, and you're going to die, too, if you don't know. That was no wonder I've grown up neurotic. But but this sort of plays a role. I mean, players did have this dire fear of blood poisoning and associated it with what you wore, right?
Players got spiked in their, you know, teams were known by their colorful socks. Obviously, the Red Sox and the Tigers got their name. They had black and orange striped socks. And when players got spiked and their wounds would be bleeding, they before Colorfast dyes, those dyes would from the socks would bleed into their wounds. And a lot of players got blood poisoning, and they thought that it was from these dyes that were getting into the wounds when they were spiked. So they cut these half moons out of the colorful socks and put on dye-free socks underneath that became known as sanitary socks. And this lasted through. When Calvin Coolidge Jr. played tennis without socks on a White House tennis court, developed a blister, eventually developed blood poisoning, and died. Obviously a national tragedy, but there was a rumor going around that it was from the dye in his socks. In fact, he was playing without socks. But, you know, 80 years later, players were still wearing these stirrups that were vestiges from this bygone era, even though we now had color-fast dyes and the stirrups served no purpose except decorative. And you know, as a little leaguer, I was still pulling on those stirrups. It made you feel like a big leaguer, even though they served no purpose. Now, of course, they're almost coming back as a nostalgia, a retro thing.
Yeah, we did a whole uniform show that I believe touched on that. We're talking to Steve Rushton. His book is The 34-Ton Bat. This is the story of baseball told through its material world and the people behind all these material goods, all these things connected to baseball. In the time that we have left, I think we should talk about bathrooms and the food that's served at baseball games. These two things obviously are connected. We can talk about the bathrooms first. One argument you make in your book is that history is so rarely told through people's bathroom habits. I mean, the exceptions being LBJ, who we knew quite a bit about, and Martin Luther, who was, you know, for the most part, constipated.
And Elvis.
And Elvis. Okay, so those would be the big three. The big three in so many different ways. Right. LBJ, Martin Luther, and Elvis. But other than that, we don't talk about bathrooms that much. But in the case of one franchise, inadequate bathrooms were a real sort of destiny-shaping quality.
Absolutely. The irony is that Charles Ebbets, owner of the Dodgers, Ebbets Field was built in 1913, and the McKeever brothers, who were in a plumbing business, were part owners of this team and helped to build Ebbets Field. And the bathrooms, almost from the beginning, were described as inadequate in press accounts. As early as the 1920s, I've seen clips of people complaining about it was a trough that wasn't fit for a horse. And you know, at least the men here have been to the trough style urinals at baseball games, and it's kind of this communal gathering place. But in the case of Ebbets Field, it was they also had issues. It stank. They didn't have adequate ventilation. People have blamed the geography of where the park was for part of that. And by the 1940s, they'd renovated it at great expense, but by the 1940s, the Dodgers themselves, management themselves, were complaining about them. By the 1950s, the O'Malleys frequently used that in their litany of complaints about Brooklyn. Most of it had to do with parking and the changing demographics of the borough and whatnot. But the bathrooms, the stinky bathrooms, always came up in this conversation. And the only way I knew about it was by talking to a friend of mine's father, who lives here in Connecticut, who grew up in Brooklyn, was a pressman at the Brooklyn Eagle. And I asked him about his going to Ebbets Field as a kid. And the second sentence, he said, you know, they had so few men's rooms, you'd wait in line forever to go to the bathroom at Ebbets Field. And all of the things I've heard about Ebbets Field, all of these elegies, I never heard anything about what a dump the bathrooms were. And that got me perversely interested in it. And, you know, so when the Dodgers moved west from Brooklyn for the 1958 season, O'Malley, installed in Los Angeles, started praising the cleanliness of the bathrooms at the LA Coliseum where they were playing their games and how bad they were back in Brooklyn. And he continued to use that as kind of one of a myriad of reasons why they moved baseball, migrated west from New York.
Just do a quick digression here. I actually do believe that history can be told this way. It can be analyzed usefully this way. And I was on a bike trip across parts of Germany this year, and we were in a town called St. Gore, which where there were this kind of old sort of medieval castle. And apparently the royalty of the castle on the highest spire would sort of – they had sort of boards hanging out around the windows. And when they needed to go to the bathroom, they would just kind of stick their butts out through the windows onto these boards and just release, and that occasionally soldiers mustering down below would suddenly find some number two on their heads, and that it was customary that they would get a little extra silver in their pay.
But perhaps history should be told exclusively this way.
Yeah, well, after that, every historical site I went to in Europe, after that, I asked numerous questions about the bathroom habits. I love the idea that they got a little extra money, and maybe like a little nice note on vellum from the king saying, I'm really sorry, I pooped on you. All right, in the time that we have left, now that your appetite is really whetted, we do have to talk a little bit about food. And one thing Steve Rushen and I have been trying to figure out is what a white pope is. The white pope occurs in this this guy writes, I think he's a sports writer, describing what the ideal baseball game would be. And in every inning, he consumes something different, ham sandwiches and hot dogs and all kinds of different things. At one point, it's like in the seventh inning, a white pope. If anybody knows what a white pope is, email me, Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. But Steve Rushen, people, it wasn't hot dogs right at the beginning. There was grilled tripe. It's amazing that went out of fashion.
Yeah, they had to invent baseball food. You know, peanuts were quickly a thing because you got thirsty and you drank beer, and beer was there from the very beginning. And but everything else sort of had to be made up as it went along, and tripe was one of the things offered for decades. I mean, well into the 1950s and early 1960s, almost every team served cake by the slice, you know, and everything in between. Obviously, when I was working, you know, cigars and cigarettes by the pack, but there were only about a half a dozen things at any given place. Now you can have 43 varieties of home brew, of micro brews and sushi and fish tacos and all that stuff. There were only ever about six or eight things that people sold, but at every place it was often something different. So Harry Stevens tried coffee at games. That was a big hit. Lemonade, nobody wanted lemonade at games. Even during Prohibition, nobody wanted lemonade. So and then places like Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Braves had a BYOB policy. You could bring as much as a half barrel of beer into the bleachers or any place else at Braves games. And when the Braves tried to dial that back in the early 1960s, the fans were outraged. You're just trying to hold us up for, you know, to buy the beer at your rates inside the ballpark. So they backpedaled on that. In 1941, when the Washington Senators ran out of beverages at Griffith Stadium, some unscrupulous vendors tried selling water to fans in the bleachers. And when this got into the Washington Post, Clark Griffith, the owner, said, no way, no, we would never do that. And then when he found out that vendors actually did, he fired them and made a big public show of apologizing to all the servicemen who had to buy water in the bleachers. But I'm sure a light bulb went on either over his head or some other owner's head that said, these people will actually buy water. And of course, now today you can buy a $4 bottle of water at any ballpark.
This guy, Harry Stevens, we're going to run out of time here, so maybe we should end with him. But he really is the guy who figures out that hot dogs and baseball go together somehow and in a way that has never been improved upon.
It really is the perfect marriage. There's a whole mythology and history behind who invented the hot dog. No one person invented the hot dog. How did the hot dog get its name? But Harry Stevens certainly was a guy who helped to massively popularize the hot dog at not just baseball games but sporting events. And you know, by 1902, they were serving them at Giants games at the Polo Grounds, where he was the concessionaire, and they were instantly the staple food of baseball. And you know, World Series accounts from 1905, there's already this romance about the baseball, the hot dogs. We didn't yet have apple pie and Chevrolet, but well, maybe we did. But the hot dog was the prominent baseball staple, and has remained to this day.
Yeah, it kind of is. It's still this thing. They can make all the fish tacos they want, you know, but really what you want that hot
There
dog.
Are no ill health effects when you're eating it at a ballpark. You might not sit down and eat three hot dogs at home, but once you step through the turnstiles, it absolves you of any ill health effects.
Eventually they'll have blood pressure cuffs attached to the seats, and you'll find out that eating that hot dog is not such a good idea. But for now, it's a thing we can do with innocence. Hey, the book, by the way, if you're dealing at all with the Aramark company, you're basically dealing with Harry Stevens. That's who bought up his hot dog empire eventually. The book is The 34-Ton Bat, The Story of Baseball, as told through bobbleheads, cracker jacks, jock straps, eye black, 375 other strange and unforgettable objects. Its author is Steve Rushen. He's here with us. We will mention parenthetically that he's married to the famous Rebecca Lobo, who was appeared in one of our songs earlier this week.
Rhyming with Killed a Hobo.
Killed a Hobo. Let those two ideas be linked together forever, please. But it's been great to visit with you. We do have a little fundraising event coming up here just in a few minutes, just towards the end of the show. First of all, we do want to thank everybody who jumps in and supports the show. You're going to hear some very nice people in the other room talk to you about supporting the show and supporting the station. But we are especially excited about our brand new, speaking of, we don't have a bobblehead yet, or for that matter, any Colin McEnroe show, Eye Black or anything. We're working on all those things. But for the first time ever, we do have merch. We have a mug. It's by Constanza Segovia. The drawing and the kind of logo is by this wonderful artist, Constanza Segovia. You're going to love the mug. It's for a gift of $60 or more. I'm doing the work for those guys in there. But please think about getting that. Thanks to Steve Rushen. Come back. Come back. We'll just talk about sports. You don't even have to.
We'll do. We'd love to. Thanks, Colin.
All right.
I'm umpire Kyone Wolf. Tucker, do you mind, as a catcher, just blocking me? I forgot my cup.
Yeah, I got you. No problem.
All right, here we go.
Oh!
Ball.
Oh!